guys, and welcome to episode 158 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I interview Johnny Say. Now, Johnny is a mindfulness teacher. He is also currently training as a psychotherapist here in the UK, and he has lived experience of OCD. And I met Johnny at one of my London meetups I used to run last year. It was great to meet him and get to know him that way. So I've got him on the podcast because I wanted him to talk about some of the things he's interested in, such as mindfulness and compassion, and also his OCD story. So it starts off by him going into his OCD story, and he goes into a lot of detail, which is great. And then we talk about the various things, like the things he's learned, the epiphanies, any roadblocks. And then the second part, we break down into, initially, what is mindfulness? What's his daily practice? How can you be mindful when you're having obsessive thoughts, these difficult thoughts? Also, how to be mindful or meditate when you feel very anxious. We talk about a lot of other things around mindfulness and meditation, which hopefully you'll find useful. But Johnny's a great guy, and I feel privileged to share this episode with you. So without further ado, here is Johnny. On the podcast today, I have Johnny Say. Johnny is a mindfulness teacher and has been practicing mindfulness and meditation for over 17 years. He is currently training as a psychotherapist, and he has lived experience of OCD. Welcome to the show, Johnny.
Thanks, Stu. Real pleasure to be here. Big fan of the show. So yeah, it's great.
Thanks, man. It's good to have you here. And of course, we met, for the people listening, at the London meetup I used to run now. I've actually stopped it for 2019. But it was good to see you there, and you're here now.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, it was great. Great speaking to you and speaking to the group. And yeah.
Cool. Right. Let's get into it. So, in as little as much detail, tell us about your OCD story.
Okay. Well, I guess OCD is an old friend of mine. I've experienced it since being very young. I actually started with panic attacks and anxiety and depersonalization and intrusive thoughts from really as long as I can remember, definitely around sort of six years old. And, some of my earliest memories are of panic attacks, actually. And I remember sitting in my primary school assembly on the floor, like you do in England, with your legs crossed and trying to behave. And I was just freaking out. I was so much depersonalization. I was just hanging onto this chair next to me. And I had a lot of panic. And it kind of felt like that was all quite woven together, and it would sort of switch between panic, depersonalization, more generalized anxiety, and then the intrusive thoughts. I kind of had all the lovely regular themes that you get with intrusive thoughts. So, a lot around harm to myself and others, and sexuality and all that kind of stuff. And when I was a kid and when I was growing up, I obviously didn't know anything about OCD, and I just was incredibly freaked out by this experience and didn't really have a clue what was going on. And I did a lot of mental compulsions, which I didn't know at the time, and it was only years later I sort of realized. But I would ruminate and check and self-reassure and just go round and round and round about these things, and then it would switch again, and it would be more just anxiety, and it would really kind of rotate between these. And there was avoidance, but I didn't do a lot of the overt compulsions, although I do remember as a little kid, little bits of that. Mm. And then I guess as I got a bit older, it switched again, and I had a period of somatosensory OCD, which it sort of developed. I guess it was more of a panicky thing first. I actually had a intense fear that I was going to lose control of my bladder, which is quite an embarrassing version, but not uncommon. And then that sort of developed into a hyper awareness. Like I was just aware of that feeling all the time. And like OCD does, it would switch from the fear of what the thoughts or what the feelings were to more a fear of those thoughts or feelings ruining your life and distracting you forever. And then it went more health anxiety and the sort of existential themes. I had a lot of health anxiety, a lot of you know, somatic experiences, and then just freaking out and thinking they were various health crises, and lots of Googling and lots of, you know, GP and all that sort of stuff. And you know, again, the mental compulsions. And there was depression woven in around that time as well. I had a number of periods of quite intense depression where I couldn't, you know, I couldn't really function very well. I lost 2 stone in a month, and I couldn't really think or do anything very well. And then the kind of existential stuff. So just the intense rumination about those big life themes that, you know, everyone might now and again think about, but this was really intense, you know, meaning, consciousness, life and death, all those sorts of unanswerable questions, and actually happiness as well. I used to have a lot around ruminating around happiness and sort of trying to figure it out and work it out. So that was kind of my experience with, and I really feel like I've had lots of other versions, and it's jumped around, and definitely had experience of it attacking uncertainty around recovery at times, and probably talk about that later because I think that's a subtle one. Sort of in parallel to that, if I can go on a bit more of my story, was my experience with meditation, really, and how I eventually came to mindfulness and compassion focused therapy and the things that I'm into now, and CBT and ERP, obviously. And really, I got into that through the martial arts. So like lots of kids, I loved martial arts and, you know, wanted to be a warrior monk or something like that, you know, like the Shaolin monks. So I trained a lot, and I through that discovered meditation and Zen, and I kind of practiced that with Qigong a lot. And yeah, I spent, you know, a good 15, maybe longer years just doing intense practice, traveling to China and Malaysia and places like that to learn from different teachers in America. And it was funny because I was definitely in some ways trying to self-medicate a bit, really, around the anxiety, the OCD and other things. And it was tricky because it helped in some ways, but in others it didn't. So I'd say like some of the basic relaxation and attentional skills and things from meditation I learned, and, you know, having a meaningful practice that was rewarding and enjoyable. But a lot of those teachers, you know, they come from the sort of Eastern medicine view, and, you know, with all respect to that worldview, because, you know, each to their own, but they would frame OCD and anxiety as more of an energetic kind of blockage that you could somehow heal if you practiced, you know, certain things in a certain way. And I, in my youthful naivety and wanting to rid myself of these intense challenges, I definitely went for that. I mean, it wasn't the only reason I practiced, but it was part of it. And then I kind of got a bit disillusioned, and I realized meditation was actually more helping me more. And I got into more the Buddhist meditation. So, you know, the Theravada, Vipassana, and the Tibetan Vajrayana, and all those sorts of traditional Buddhist practices with Zen as well. And I was practicing that a lot, and again, quite probably too intensely and just going for it, really. And there's a movement called the pragmatic Dharma, or the hardcore Dharma, which is like a modern pragmatic approach to that, where they, you know, you take what works from different schools and then do a lot of intense practice. And I was very into that and kind of following some of those teachers like Daniel Ingram and Kenneth Folk and Shinzen Young and all those guys. And they've got a lot of amazing stuff. But for me, as someone with OCD, it just made me practice way too intensely. And you know, again, there was things that helped, and, you know, there's paradoxes with this stuff, but I kind of started to realize that perhaps that wasn't the right way. And I gravitated more towards mindfulness. And then I did have a couple of rounds of CBT, and some medication. And the first couple of rounds, they were brilliant therapists, but I didn't fully commit to it because I was still quite meditation focused. And then later, I went for therapy with Rob Wilson, who I know you've had on the show, and he's brilliant. And really, it was working with him that I really got into ERP and kind of really committed to that and started practicing that and, pushing into uncertainty and all those things. And I learned a lot from Rob, and I still use all of that. And he's very compassion focused, so I learned compassion stuff there. And I did the mindfulness teacher training, and I did that at Bangor and other bits of teacher training and compassion focused therapy training with Paul Gilbert, who's another one you've had on the show. He's great.
Good guy.
I guess that got me to where I am today, and really, and as you said, studying psychotherapy as well is something to support all of that and to sort of move towards working as a therapist with mindfulness, with compassion, and with CBT and other things. So, yeah, it kind of got me to where I am today.
Well, thank you for that. It's really interesting. And how does we'll probably get into compassion later on when we talk about mindfulness and stuff. But in your own journey, how did compassion really start to play a role in your recovery?
Yeah, I'd say it played a massive role. And it's funny because some of the early Qigong teachers I learned from were very into compassion. They had Tibetan Buddhist influences. And, even when I was practicing it with them, I noticed a kind of correlation of it just softening some of the edges of OCD and beginning to build that sort of compassionate self, which I didn't frame it like that. It was only later when I learned from Paul Gilbert. But I think for me, the big part of it is that, with all mental health challenges, there can be this big component of shame underneath them. And also there can be this vulnerable part of us that is kind of sitting underneath it. And I think the compassion work is really, for me, the best way to develop and strengthen that. And I love the compassion focused therapy. That's sort of my main practice, really. But all the likes of Kristen Neff, self-compassion, and all that sort of modern work on compassion and the research, and I've learned a lot from that, and it's an ongoing journey. And I think compassion is a skill you build and something you develop. So really, I would say around that vulnerable, perhaps shameful part of me, and strengthening that, and in compassion focused therapy, you also work with a therapist to do that. So I think working in that relationship and building that with someone else can be really useful as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Thank you for that. And last question then around your story is you obviously talked about doing martial arts and the other stuff around that. Was there any other sort of lifestyle changes that you made?
I think lifestyle is a big part of recovery, and I think it always needs to be underlined with you don't want to do any of these things to get rid of OCD, but it's to support you and the kind of ACT value-based thing that you want to nourish yourself. And Rob taught me a lot about that, and because I went there with depression as well, he helped me a lot with behavioral activation. So there was a lot about lifestyle and linking to ACT and the values, and realizing how kind of the way I was living at that point was out of sync with my values and goals. So yeah, I think the behavioral stuff for me, obviously the obvious things like exercise, there's really no better simple mental health intervention. And I went to a seminar with Kelly Wilson a little while ago from ACT, and he said an interesting thing. He said that mental health challenges are like diseases of captivity. So you know where like a killer whale's fin starts to droop when they're kept in small things. Well, he was saying that because we're not living this life like we're evolved to, like our nervous system from the Pleistocene era epoch is, designed to be outside, running, walking for 6, 8 hours a day, in the light with our family. So I think getting as close to all of those things as you can within
It's very
the
interesting.
context. And I think those lifestyle changes are massive, really, especially if you have depression with OCD. I love Mark Freeman's stuff, and I know you've had him on here, and I think his integration of ACT and kind of ERP and how can you make getting back into a meaningful value-based life part of your exposure as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a really interesting take. It kind of makes sense. We're so disconnected from nature and from what we're naturally meant to be doing. Stuck in offices, I work in an office, so I mean artificial lighting and air for 8 hours a day, sitting down for most of it. And then when I come home, I've only recently got back onto exercise. But still, I wasn't exercising either. So all these things just compound, and over 30 years, what's the impact?
They do, and it was interesting because Rob told me that with health anxiety, along with CBT, the other NICE recommended treatment is stress management. So actually, lowering your stress, and it's a paradox because you don't want to lower your stress to try and get rid of OCD. You want to lower your stress because you want to have a relaxed and enjoyable and peaceful life. But it does kind of work together. And I remember once I went on holiday after having, really intense OCD, and within a day or so it just dropped away, and I didn't I did barely anything. I was just walking in the mountains, hanging out with my wife and or she girlfriend at the time she was, and it just kind of melted away. And so I think, obviously we've got to be careful that those things don't become compulsions, but there's a correlation with stress. And I really like positive psychology as well. So I think, some of the principles from that with gratitude and with savoring and with flow as well. I'm a big, big fan of flow. I think those things can all be part of a recovery, and they can kind of augment the exposure work, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Okay, so I lied before. A couple more questions on your story. Not
Sure,
intentionally, I want to admit.
no problem.
So, what was the biggest epiphany for you in your recovery?
I mean, I guess when I really committed to ERP with Rob was a big shift. There's been other epiphanies, definitely, but I think that one, I think up until that point, I'd done bits of ERP, but I'd always thought, if I meditated enough, I'd sort this. And then it was only realizing that actually, there's something very different about pushing into that anxiety and uncertainty, and it teaches the brain in quite a different way. And obviously we have state-dependent learning in the brain, so not everything the brain learns generalizes to all contexts. So you can get very good at sitting on a cushion, which I did, and as someone who had had early onset arthritis, and I'd skateboarded a lot as a kid, so I had knackered knees. I had a lot of pain sitting, and I got brilliant at sitting through pain. I could sit for an hour, 2 hours with a lot of pain. But then it doesn't, that kind of skill doesn't always generalize. So I think ERP and the more modern take on ERP, where you're doing it in different ways, intermittently, in different contexts, sometimes with imaginal, sometimes with in life stuff. And I think the other geeky science bit around the inhibitory learning, and that we're creating these new pathways that we have to strengthen and solidify, and when we're stressed there's a chance the old one might light up again, and so we have to use these tools and work with them. And I think it's much the same with compassion. If you haven't internalized that compassionate inner voice and that self-compassion, then you develop it and you build it, and then the old critic might come back now and again. But you know, if we develop that inhibitory compassion, if you like, then, you know, it just gets stronger and stronger. And I think the other epiphany for me, and I don't think this happens to everyone, I've had clients in placements and things like that who have OCD that it seems to just be one theme and then they're kind of back to life or whatever. But for me, learning to spot the patterns, and again, Mark Freeman talks about this a lot, that you're looking for the pattern of OCD rather than the specific themes, because I found that it would target the uncertainty in recovery a bit. So, you know, I think it reminds me, you had Fred Penzel on before, and he wrote a brilliant article on this, Both Ends Against the Middle, I think it's called, and it's all about the ways OCD can kind of try and sabotage recovery a little bit, and I experienced a lot of that. So, you know, the perfect way to do exposure, or, you know, it can switch themes and throw you quite intense anxiety symptoms, or for me, depersonalization, because I had a lot of that when you start dropping compulsions and kind of mix in with depression and get some hopelessness, you know, that voice of like, I'll never recover. And you have to expose to that is where you have to go, I'll never recover. I'll be miserable the rest of my life. Great, you know, and all that sort of thing. And so the subtlety, I think, and spotting the pattern really that was an epiphany. And the last epiphany that's coming to mind is the mental compulsions and the subtlety of those. And I do think mindfulness helps a lot with that, but they're still sneaky and subtle, and it's learning that principle. Rob talked about this, and he has it in his book really nicely. It's the thoughts versus the thinking, and, you know, you have the intrusive thoughts that everyone has. We have little to no, well, probably no control over, but then we have the thinking, the reaction to that, and that's the bit you've got to try and work out. And I think there's a bit of a gray area in between where some of it's a bit automatic and it takes a while to work out. Like with checking, for example, like say you're automatically kind of, you know, you've had some sort of intrusive thought and then you're automatically checking. Some of that checking can be quite unconscious almost. And just getting in there with mindfulness to find what you can control, what you can't, accepting what you can, letting go of what you accepting what you can't control and letting go of what you can. I found that really useful, and I think it's an ongoing skill, really, is learning to manage those mental compulsions.
Absolutely, it's a tough one to notice them sometimes, because it's easier to notice you've just checked the door five times or you've been washing your hands for 10 minutes, but it's more difficult to realize you've been ruminating over something for the last 30 minutes. And sometimes I got caught last night, but then after a couple of minutes, part of me was like, oh, I think this is a compulsion. I think it's OCD, and it didn't make it necessarily that much easier because it still felt horrible. But it was that flag to me to say, okay, I can either keep doing this and know it's going to get worse, or I can try and refuse to kind of do this compulsion, go do something else, and it's going to feel horrible. But I have to trust that anxiety will go. Sure enough, it did.
It's
catching that, isn't it? And
it is. It does. I really do think mindfulness helps a lot with that, because you just get more aware of the mental processes that are happening day to day. And it's equally appropriate to depression or any of these things where you have a lot of rumination or a lot of thought going on. And I really like John Hirschfield's stuff on this. And actually, in my story, it was actually discovering John Hirschfield that pointed me to the fact that I had OCD. So, because he had the mindfulness for OCD, I think I read Jeffrey Schwartz's book first, and then the Hirschfield book. And that his work around this is great. He's got an article on his blog about how to respond to to the thoughts. And I think he does a lot of really good stuff around this, and I learned a lot from him actually. And Rob does as well. And Rob, you know, Rob has this metaphor around the cars on the road. And I think it's David Veal's metaphor actually, but you know, I learned it from Rob. And you know, we want to be on the pavement with the people we're with, living our life, you know, being aware of what's on the pavement, intrusive thoughts, the urges, images, the difficult emotions of the cars on the road, and we can't shut them out, we can't block them out, but we also can't, we don't want to climb in and start trying to flag them down or anything like that. So, you know, at times you notice them, at times they're so in the background you don't, you know, they're just floating past. I think that's a great metaphor for it. And it's something, yeah, I find people kind of get it. Even people I know who, you know, they would never practice mindfulness, that metaphor is sort of meaningful to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good one. And yeah, for me, metaphors are huge. Like, they just explain so much in such a short time that, yeah, even if you don't practice mindfulness, they can give you that framework in and of itself. So next time you have this thought process, you can remember the cars metaphor and be like, am I going to interact with the traffic, or am I going to ignore it, or just accept that it's there? So we're going to get onto mindfulness and all that in a sec and unpack all that. But yeah, what was a roadblock for you in your recovery, and how did you overcome it?
I definitely had lots of lapses, you know, and I would get a sense that I'd kind of got a grip on OCD, and, you know, I might still have some anxiety or some other things, but the more the OCD part had died down, and then it might come back. And at first that was really tough. And then I think with a few of those and developing your skills and actually more acceptance and building that ability to work with whatever your brain throws at you, that was initially a roadblock, and now not such a problem. I mean, you know, if your mind's calm and peaceful, great. If it's disturbed and like a pond that's been stirred up, then it is what it is. And, you know, can you keep on the pavement? Like, can you keep being on the pavement with the people you care about, doing the things you enjoy? And you get into trouble as soon as you try and get rid of those cars on the road. You know, it just, it doesn't work like that, unfortunately. And, you know, the brain, as soon as you start forcing it to do something, it sees that as a something to be worried about and send alert signals about. So, you know, I think that was a roadblock originally. And I think it's so tricky because, you know, you want to just believe there's some sort of magic fix with something like this, but really, and this is again where I think Mark Freeman's bang on with his sort of mental fitness model, is that, you know, these are skills and tools, and everyone's dealing with a tricky brain. I mean, that's a compassion focused therapy thing. You know, we inherit these very tricky brains. They're a mix of different animals, basically. You know, we've got the lizard, the monkey, the human, and however else you look at it, and they don't always work how we might want them to, but can we build up more acceptance and more kindness with that, more support? And those are just skills that you can just develop more and more, you know, and I think neuroscience is great for that, because it shows us this plasticity and how you can, you know, you can do this inhibitory learning, or you can wire up different modes and different ways of being.
Yeah, really good point and good answer. And thank you for sharing your story. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good to share it.
Cool. So on to the next part, which is going to be sort of mindfulness and meditation. So, what is mindfulness? It's a good place to start.
It's a great question. I mean, it's sometimes criticized in the literature for being quite a diffuse term that, you know, it encapsulates many things. The way I describe it is it's both a principle and a set of exercises to cultivate that principle. So, you know, mindfulness is this present moment attention in a non-judgmental, accepting, kind way. And you know, the modern version of it is obviously most associated with Jon Kabat-Zinn and his mindfulness-based stress reduction. So that has a set of practices to cultivate mindfulness. But really, you find mindfulness in all cultures throughout history. And you know, there are subtle different views of it, and you know, there are different, probably different skills involved. But essentially, it's this present moment attention with acceptance. I prefer acceptance to non-judgment because I think, you know, our brains to some extent automatically judge, but acceptance is something we build. The actual practices are different things. So they can be sitting practices, they can be movement, they can be lying, and they can focus on a narrow range of attention, so something like the sensations of the breath, or you know, the body scan. They're often where we begin in mindfulness, so sweeping the attention through the body, and there are also movement practices, so you know, yoga, tai chi, things like that are great for it. But equally, you can run mindfully, you can work out mindfully, you can do anything where you're gently having your attention in the present moment. When it drifts away, you're coming back. And I think the other part of it is, it's for me, it's a very relaxed and gentle awareness, and you're just using enough attention to stay with the practice, but no more than that. So, you know, you look around your office at work, you see everyone concentrating, and they're like shoulders up and the brows furrowed, and they're absolutely wiped out after a day of that. Whereas mindfulness is much softer and more gentle, and you're really, and that builds the acceptance. I mean, that's the way I view mindfulness. People have, you know, different definitions, but that to me is one that works.
Okay, cool. Thank you. And your sort of daily practice, whether that's meditation or mindfulness, how often or what is it like bringing it into your day-to-day?
Yeah, I mean, I practice daily. At times, as I said in my story, I've practiced a lot, and I would say too much. And that can have problems, you know, for certain people, and in certain ways that can not be the best thing. But my daily practice now, I mean, I am particularly focused on compassion-focused therapy. So I do a lot of compassion practices, and I do mindfulness as well. And so I'll do a sitting practice daily. I'll do some movement daily, and both of those will vary in length of time depending on what's going on in my life. And I try and integrate it into what I do. And so I'm trying to use compassion, mindfulness throughout my day, trying to be present when I'm with people, you know, noticing when I'm drifting away and everything else. And I think also the other part, I mean, I sometimes talk about mindfulness has the skills for helping you manage difficult aspects of life, but it also can enhance the positive. And this is where, for me, you have savoring. So you really savor the present moment experience. And in savoring, it's not quite like mindfulness, because mindfulness is open and accepting, and takes the good the same as the bad. Whereas savoring is selectively attending to positive things, and also feeling that in your body, and letting your awareness dance between those. So I do that as well, and I, you know, I do gratitude, and I practice. I try and bring it into my life, really. And I'm a big fan of the short practices. So, you know, the stop practice, the 3-minute breathing space, the mindful self-compassion break, and the one that I like, and I created called TLC, which is take a breath, label your experience, compassion, bring compassion in your thoughts and behavior.
Nice. Say that one again for those that don't want to rewind the podcast.
TLC. So I've written an article on my blog that kind of goes into more detail, but it's take a breath. So obviously, the soothing breathing rhythm is always useful. Labels, so you can just be mindfully aware, but often using a silent internal label is very useful. And there's research that shows that there's actually really interesting research where they tested the stress response, and they do this in a lovely way in the lab. They get people with arachnophobia to approach spiders, and they measure their heart rate and their galvanic skin response and all the rest of it, and they try different interventions, and actually labeling has been one of the really powerful ones. So they approach the spider and go, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling very afraid, this is really tricky, you know, and all that kind of thing. So and labeling is easier, I think, if you've not practiced mindfulness much. And some of the traditional practices, like there's a Mahasi style of meditation that really uses this noting and labeling a lot. And it can get you, it can help you be mindful, I think. And then compassion, final stage. So either being compassionate in your thoughts or in your behavior.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah, I'll put a link to that article in the show notes, so people can check that out. Cool. So a key, I've been asked this a few times and I've seen it many times. And the question is, so how can I be mindful, whether that's being mindful, whether it's say mindful walking or whether that's meditation, how can I do this when I have so many horrible thoughts going through my head?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I definitely had this experience, especially early days, and it is really tough. And I think, you know, the first thing, always being compassionate with yourself, it is really difficult. And these difficult, challenging, intrusive thoughts, you know, they're really painful. So I think compassion, I think it's always great to start with small doses and gradually build up. So, you know, begin with real short practices, just do a minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, and kind of build up from there. For a lot of people, the actual sitting can be a little bit too stressful at first, so some movement might be better. But really, we're wanting to gradually build our acceptance of those thoughts. Mm. And I like to see acceptance as a spectrum, and we're all somewhere on it. And, you know, at the highest end, you have these meditation masters who can, you know, they measure pain response and they show very little reaction and all the rest of it. And then, you know, further down it, there might be, you're starting to build acceptance. You're more okay with those thoughts. Below that, you might have tolerance. So, you know, you don't want them, but you can just about put up with them. And then below that, you might really not want these thoughts, and it's really tough. So we can build that acceptance over time and just gradually practice in and trying to build that acceptance. And I think the labeling can be helpful. So, you know, to help you get that distance from it. And really, you know, if we're starting a meditation practice, you know, a lot of my students find that having an object for concentration is the easiest. So the breath or, you know, sounds or the body or sights, and then noticing when your attention gets pulled away and gently coming back. And so we're trying to let those intrusive thoughts be in the background so that we're not trying to push them away, not doing anything with them, but we're not giving them all our attention. Our attention's on the breath or, you know, whatever the object is. And I think, you know, then it doesn't matter if those thoughts are there. And then ironically, at that point, that's when they start to drop away. And so I guess just practicing. And then if it doesn't feel right, you know, for some people, it is really tough. And maybe you need to use other techniques. There might be other ways to practice mindfulness with music or, you know, doing, you know, art or creative practices or something like that, knitting, whatever it is that can be relaxing and a bit meditative. But still do the same thing. Notice when your mind drifts away and gently come back. I don't think it has to be mindfulness. I think mindfulness is brilliant because it's stripped down to the simplest equation. It's just, you know, you sitting or standing. But you can definitely build into that with other tools.
Yeah.
And have a supportive group, you know, talk with people, work with a therapist as well, a therapist who ideally understands ERP and meditation or mindfulness.
Yeah, really, really good points. So somewhat similar then is similar question, but using emotion that's the problem. So sitting there or being mindful when, you're just swamped with anxiety, or maybe it's guilt or shame or some other strong emotion.
Yeah, and it is tough. It's really tough. These emotions are evolved to hijack our attention and our behavior and get us to react. And so it is very difficult, especially when you're very activated. And I think, you know, building up to it, it might not be right in the beginning to try and sit with anything that's too intense. You might be better again to go and do something relaxing, or, you know, I think dialectical behavior therapy has a lot of good stuff around emotional regulation and how to work with those intense emotions that are almost a bit too much for a lot of people in the start of meditation. And so, you know, sometimes it might be better to go and work out or do something else. But if you're starting to build your acceptance, again, it's the same thing. You can work with it with an object of attention. So your mind's on the breath, you have this overwhelming body sensation, you notice it, you try and gently and with kindness accept it and then bring your attention back. Or later you might observe the emotion a little bit and be mindful of that and the thoughts that go with it, and also the reaction to all that, the aversion and the tensing up that goes around those difficult emotions. But it might not be right always to sit with those. So I think really listening to yourself and where you feel you are with that, and especially people with a trauma history, it can be very intense. And then the brain can then focus on what is most distressing and amplify it. And they call this somatosensory amplification. And then basically you get more and more overwhelm. And so in that case, you want to be working with a therapist who understands mindfulness and can ease you into it. And it might be that you do more working with positive, resourceful things like the savoring practice. So you're more having attention around something that's enjoyable. You're out in nature and you're savoring the walk and the beauty, or you're with someone talking and you're enjoying the connection and being with them. And that might be a better mindfulness practice to begin with. So there's lots of ideas there. I kind of don't want to overwhelm too much with too many options, but the other one is the compassion. So, you know, bringing compassion to those difficult emotions. And I think, again, John Hirschfeld and Charlotte Nicely in their new book, they have a really nice bit around the self-compassion coping statement. And I think that kind of self-compassion work can be really helpful with this. Labeling, again, there's a lot of evidence that if you actually just describe that painful emotion to yourself, it kind of gives you that distance and that observing from it. And then bring in, like in compassion focused therapy, we would work with imagery. So you would bring in, you know, you connect with your compassionate self, and then you bring in perhaps a compassionate image. So you might have an animal or someone who's very compassionate, and they come and support you, and they might say compassionate, supportive things to you. And I think there's a lot on self-compassion and working with those difficult emotions. And Paul Gilbert has a lot of that in his books and things. So I would explore that as well. So, I mean, what's really interesting is that Jon Kabat-Zinn, when he developed mindfulness, he didn't teach compassion explicitly because he felt that mindfulness was compassion. So the way your awareness meets those difficult emotions should be compassionate and kind. And then later they did start doing more of the loving kindness practice and things. So really having that kind of mindfulness as well, really gentle, accepting, kind, with those difficult emotions.
Yeah, really good answer there. Loads to unpack. Okay, so we talked about nature already, and I'm always looking at ways to enjoy my time more when I'm in nature, And just to clarify, as I've done before, when I say nature, it doesn't have to be the great outdoors, you know, miles from anyone. It could literally just be a park with some trees. So let's say, you know, I'm or one of the listeners are going for one of these walks. What are some of the ways they can be mindful on that walk?
Yeah, it's
or
a great
savor
place.
Or compassion or anything.
Yeah, it's a great way to practice. I've got a lovely old dog called Benji, so I'm always out walking in nature, and he's my compassionate and mindful companion, definitely. And I think there's lots of practices you can do. So I really like what I call the gratitude walk, and again, I've written a bit about this on my blog. So going out and expressing gratitude in your mind for things you feel grateful for. And then going into the detail of why you feel grateful for them. So could be the beauty of nature, and then because it relaxes me, I feel calmer and connected. And so that can be a nice practice. Obviously, you can do any of the mindfulness practices whilst you're walking in nature. You know, typically, as long as you're in a safe place, you know, you don't want to be doing close attention of the sensations in your feet if you're in, you know, somewhere where you could walk into a road or something. But generally, you might have more of an open awareness. You're aware of what you can see, what you can hear, what you can smell and taste maybe as well. I really like savoring in nature, and you can do this in kind of two ways, and people like doing it in different ways. So for some people, it's as simple as you just notice the beauty of nature, what's pleasant in your environment, and then you feel how that feels in the body. So is there an openness in your chest? Is there a warmth? Is there a smile on your face? Is there a lightness? You know, all those pleasant sensations. And you let your attention dance back and forth between what you see and what you feel. But you can also, some people like to do a kind of soft, silent narrate internally of what they can see. So, you know, I'm seeing the beauty of this trees and I feel so good and this is wonderful, and whatever feels right for you, and doing it with a compassionate, kind inner voice. And that can be really helpful. And then the other side of it is remembering that if OCD comes along, if depression, depersonalization, whatever comes along, can you let it walk with you in nature? Because otherwise you can put a lot of pressure on, you know, I'm in this beautiful place and I'm still being terrorized
by
my
mind. Why aren't I enjoying
it?
Why am I ruining this? Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, exactly. So we really want to do it in parallel. We want to be, our attention is really in the moment where we are focused on the beauty. And if painful thoughts and emotions are there, as best we can, we let them come along for the ride. Yeah. Easier said than done when you're in a tough place, but
But like you said, it's a skill, it's a muscle. You know, you don't expect to lift heavy weights straight away when you go to the gym. It takes years to get to that point, or months, or whatever it is. But
exactly. Okay. And being with other people as well, savoring can be really enhanced when you're with other people that are enjoying it. And, you know, our nervous system is very much designed to regulate from face-to-face contact with someone we know, who we trust and care about us. And so being in nature with someone who, you know, you love and care about can really calm and soothe you as well. And sometimes that's exactly what you need, you know, when you're in a difficult place.
Yeah, good point. Okay, so covered a lot there, and there's a lot hopefully for people to go on and start testing. So a few different questions now. So if you could call your 20-year-old self, what would you tell that young man?
I'd say ease off on the skateboard and your knees are going to be knackered. No, I guess... You know, it's one of these paradoxical things, because in a way you have to go on the journey that you go on and everything else. But, you know, in a way, I guess if I discovered ERP and CBT earlier, it would have helped me, definitely. Yeah. But really, I guess it would have been to somehow encourage myself to develop self-compassion at that point.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. And you've got a billboard in London. What do you want written on that billboard?
Good. I love this question. It's a classic. It's definitely something around compassion because I also think the world needs
Yeah,
that.
absolutely.
So I think it would be something like just be kind, and then maybe in brackets in your head. Because
Yeah.
I think if a lot of people are kind in their heads, then it ripples out and everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think kind is a word that really resonates with me because I feel compassion can, like mindfulness, can get lost sometimes.
Yeah.
But kind is so black and white, at least in my interpretation of it, of what it means.
Yeah.
So when you say be kind to yourself, to me sometimes that's easier to grapple than be compassionate to yourself. You
Yeah,
know?
yeah, yeah. I mean, compassion in CFT is really a sensitivity to suffering and a desire and motivation to alleviate it. But I agree, kind, it's so, we've all been encouraged to be kind
You
by,
get
you
taught
know,
it as a kid, right? The word kind comes up so much, whereas compassion is not something I ever heard, I don't think.
No, exactly. So
Yeah.
there's a more of this, yeah, there's more of a connection with kindness. Yeah, I agree, yeah.
Cool. And is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you wish you could have shared?
Oh, I think there's something for me around, I've come across people who are struggling with, ERP and engaging with it, or it's just really difficult. And to realize that actually some supportive, compassionate therapy around that might be really useful and might help you to build the skills to engage in that painful and difficult exposure. And I like some of I'm thinking Reed Wilson when he says, there can be a place for the crutches, so we might need some of those crutches to help us start to engage in exposure to then do it more and more on our own. Or so I think there are different routes into it, and the research shows a lot of people drop out of ERP in studies. So I think sometimes a supportive, compassionate, collaborative foundation can really help with that. So yeah, I think look for that if you're struggling, really.
Yeah, really good point. I've come across that too before as well. Cool. Well, look, thank you so much for sharing your stories, being so open, vulnerable, and your expertise in meditation and mindfulness. I found that extremely useful.
Thanks, Stu. I've really enjoyed chatting with you. It's been great. So yeah, appreciate that. Thanks.
So there you have it. I really hope you enjoyed my chat with Johnny. And quick disclaimer, guys, that this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Until we speak, take care.